December 19th, 1949, Juneau County, Wisconsin. A fire breaks out at the residence of 4-year-old Ricky Jean Bryant, nicknamed Jeannie, which burns her family's house to the ground. While Jeannie's remains cannot be found in the rubble, the authorities conclude that she died in the fire. As the years go by, Jeannie's siblings are bothered by a number of suspicious discrepancies, including the presence of an unidentified blonde woman who stopped by the house while the fire was taking place. They begin to believe that their mother and grandmother orchestrated Jeannie's disappearance and she might still be alive somewhere, but even though they convince the authorities to open a new investigation, there are no conclusive answers about what happened. After that, the trail went cold. Hello everyone and welcome to our latest episode of The Trail Went Cold. I'm your host Robin Warder, and this week, we're going to be covering this month's final holiday-themed mystery, the 1949 disappearance of 4-year-old Ricky Jean Bryant. It's always been a tradition for our podcast to spend the month of December featuring mysteries which took place around Christmas, and while searching for cases to cover this year, I came across an interesting article which was recently written by my friend Crystal Dawn at her website LostAndFoundBlogs.com. And apologies in advance, but after my previous episodes about the disappearances of the Sodder children and Mary Elizabeth Edens, this will mark the third time we've covered the depressing topic of children who vanished during a fire which took place right before Christmas. In those other two aforementioned cases, there was always debate about whether the children were killed in the fire or were abducted from the scene by an unknown party, and the same logic applies to Ricky Jean Bryant, who went by the name Jeannie. On the surface, this might appear to be nothing more than another tragic story about a child who was killed in a fire, but there's some very suspicious oddities surrounding this event, which give off the impression that there's a lot more to it than meets the eye. After Jeannie disappeared, her mother forbade her other children from ever talking about her or mentioning her name, and as they got older, Jeannie's surviving siblings began to realize that the official account of the house fire did not add up. Since Jeannie's brother recalled seeing an unidentified blonde woman suddenly appear and disappear at the scene that day, there has been speculation that Jeannie's mother and grandmother might have faked her death and orchestrated her disappearance in order to cover up the fact that she was conceived out of wedlock during an extramarital affair. While no conclusive evidence has ever been found to prove that Jeannie is still alive, her siblings managed to convince the local sheriff's office to reopen the case, and it is currently in active investigation. This is definitely one of the oddest missing children's cases I've come across in quite some time, so I thought it would be an ideal choice for a holiday-themed episode. Anyway, before we get started, just a quick reminder that The Trail Went Cold is a weekly podcast, which is currently available for download on several platforms, including Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, and Spotify. So if you like this podcast, be sure to subscribe to it, and please leave us a rating or review on any of those sites to help spread the word. The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so if you would like to learn how to support the show, please visit our page at patreon.com/thetrailwentcold. For as little as $1 a month, you can garner access to exclusive rewards, which may include stickers and thank you cards, early access to episodes, and bonus content. I also just wanted to mention that at the time of this episode's release, I'll be away on Christmas vacation, but our podcast is still going to be providing content during my absence. Next week, on December the 28th, we'll be releasing a special Q&A episode, and our first episode of 2023, which comes out on January the 4th, is going to be another special update episode about cases from The Trail Went Cold which have either been solved or had major developments over the past year. So with all that out of the way, let us now explore the disappearance of Ricky Jean Bryant. Our story begins in 1949 in Juneau County, Wisconsin, and our central figure is 4-year-old Ricky Jean Bryant, who goes by the name Jeannie. Jeannie lives with her parents, Raymond and Opal Bryant, on a farm located on County Road G, 3 miles outside the small town of Mouston, which had a population of just over 3,000 at that time. She is the third of 4 children in her family, as she has 2 sisters, 9-year-old Sharon and 18-month-old Liz, as well as a 4-year-old brother named Forrest. On December the 19th, the children's parents were away from their farm, as Opal worked at a local garment factory, while Raymond worked as a truck driver who was out on a run to Chicago. Sharon was attending school that day, so the 3 youngest children were being watched over by their maternal grandparents, Casper and Helen Halverson. However, at around 3 p.m. that afternoon, a fire broke out at the Bryant's farmhouse, and by the time the local volunteer fire department arrived at the scene and doused the flames, the house completely burned to the ground. While Forrest, Liz, and their 2 grandparents safely made it outside the residence, Jeannie was missing. The story provided by Helen Halverson was that once the fire started, she immediately took Forrest and Liz outside to safety and then ran back inside to search for Jeannie. Even though Helen said she called out for her granddaughter several times, she received no response. Casper Halverson was in an upstairs bedroom, but since he was an invalid and the staircase wound up collapsing in the flames, Helen knew that he would never be able to make it out of the house on his own. So Helen proceeded to run back outside, put a ladder up next to the house, and then climbed it in order to rescue her husband by pulling him out the bedroom window. Helen then carried Casper down to the ground below, and while he received some burns on his face and hands, which required hospitalization, he managed to pull through. But sadly, even after the fire department performed a search of the rubble, no trace of Jeannie could be found. At the time the fire started, the children had been playing in a downstairs closet located underneath the stairs, so it was feared that Jeannie may have rushed upstairs and found herself trapped when the staircase collapsed. In addition, one of the firefighters reported that when he first arrived at the scene, he thought he could hear screams from the residents, though he could not track down the source of the screams when he ran inside. A search of the ruins did turn up some small fragments of what were believed to be bone particles, and while they were sent away to the state crime laboratory in Madison for analysis, the results were reported as coming back as negative. But even though Jeannie's remains could not be found, the fire had been hot enough to melt metal inside the house, so the authorities concluded that Jeannie likely perished in the blaze. A local resident agreed to lend out his home to the Bryant family so they would be able to celebrate the holidays. On Christmas Day, Opal put a star on the Christmas tree and told the other children that Jeannie was now a star in heaven. But according to Jeannie's siblings, this would be the last time their mother allowed the family to talk about Jeannie or say her name. Even though the family never held a funeral and no death certificate was ever issued, Opal and Helen seemed to accept the authorities' ruling that Jeannie died in the fire. However, Raymond was more reluctant to believe that his daughter was dead, as he performed his own search of the farmhouse's rubble no less than 3 times, and could not find any conclusive evidence that Jeannie's remains were there. The family gradually moved on with their lives, but in 1959, Raymond and Opal got divorced. Opal decided to move to Washington State in order to get remarried, and took her youngest child Liz with her, but Sharon and Forrest remained in Wisconsin in the custody of their father. It was not until 1985, when Sharon, Forrest, and Liz decided to reunite and discuss Jeannie's disappearance, and finally opened up about some strange events which took place that day. I just mentioned how after a star was placed on the Christmas tree in Jeannie's honor, Opal forbid her other children from ever talking about her. Well, on the day of the fire, Sharon was at a nearby schoolhouse, and since she was able to see her farmhouse burning in the distance, she had to be restrained by her teacher in order to prevent her from running home. When Opal showed up at the schoolhouse to pick up Sharon later that day, she immediately told her that Jeannie was now an angel and she was never to mention Jeannie's name again, which Sharon found very odd. Obviously, since Liz was only 18 months old when the fire took place, she had no memory of that day, but Forrest wound up sharing a surprising story which seemed to contradict their grandmother Helen's account of what happened. Even though Helen claimed that she took Forrest and Liz outside into the yard and ran back into the burning house to search for Jeannie, Forrest maintained that Jeannie was with them at the time. After Helen went back into the house to rescue their grandfather, Forrest said that an unidentified blonde woman pulled up onto their property, driving what Forrest described as an expensive-looking car. The woman urged Forrest to go get help and directed him towards a house located down the road where a neighbor named Irene Carlson lived. Even though there was another house in the opposite direction which was much closer, the woman told Forrest that their phone wasn't working, which is why he needed to go to the Carlson residence instead. Forrest did as he was instructed, but by the time he returned to the farmhouse several minutes later, Liz was still out in the front yard, but Jeannie, the blonde woman, and her car were now gone. Forrest's story compelled the three siblings to track down Irene Carlson, and her account of the events which took place that day only opened up more questions. Irene did confirm that Forrest showed up at her house and asked her to call for help, and afterwards, they both ran back to the Bryant farm. When they arrived, Liz was out in the front yard, so Irene put her and Forrest inside the family car before she ran into the farmhouse to look for Jeannie. Irene went into the kitchen and came across Helen collecting canned goods, and when she asked where Jeannie was, Helen told her that Jeannie was gone. In spite of this, Irene still tried searching through the burning house for the child until Helen stepped in and told her that Jeannie was now with relatives. She also asked Irene to help her get a fur coat which belonged to Opal out of the house. Well, obviously, Jeannie was not with relatives that day, and the existence of this fur coat was another odd detail. Opal and Helen did not have a lot of money at the time, so the children wondered how they would have been able to afford a fur coat to begin with. Even though the house did not have any insurance on it, and the family pretty much lost all of their personal possessions in the fire, Opal and Helen seemed to have additional money following the incident for reasons that were never explained. While they were growing up, the children seemed to recall numerous instances when Opal would take off on unexplained trips without telling them where she was going, and the kids would be left in Helen's care. According to Sharon, quote, "My grandma never went anywhere. She was always covering up stuff my mom would do," end quote. When referring to her mother, Sharon once stated, quote, "She was never home. As soon as my dad would go, about an hour later, my mom would take off," end quote. When Opal and Raymond divorced in 1959, and Opal moved to Washington with Liz, Sharon and Forrest recalled their mother saying that the reason she was not taking them with her was because they were, quote-unquote, too much like their father. Over the years, Opal would periodically return to Wisconsin in order to visit her children, and Sharon said there were numerous times in which her mother would take her to Minnesota. But Opal would then drop off Sharon with relatives and disappear for days at a time without telling her daughter where she went. In 1979, Opal suddenly told her children that she wanted to get a headstone for Jeannie. Even though there was no casket buried underneath it, the headstone was placed in a cemetery in Hesper, Iowa, where some of Opal's other relatives were buried. The Bryant siblings eventually tracked down Lois Kane, who was their mother's second cousin, and had a close relationship with Opal as they were growing up. Lois told them that Jeannie did not actually die in the fire and advised them to keep searching for her, cryptically stating that they would, quote-unquote, be surprised at what they'd find. According to Lois, while she was looking through a family scrapbook, she recognized a photo of a man that Opal had supposedly carried on a secret affair with even before she divorced Raymond. Lois said that this man had a daughter that would be around Jeannie's age, which led to speculation that Raymond was not Jeannie's biological father, as Opal and the other man may have conceived the child out of wedlock. Jeannie's siblings now wondered if the fire had been a diversion orchestrated by Opal and Helen in order to fake Jeannie's death and secretly place her in the care of her birth father, where she was raised under a false identity. In 2005, Sharon and Liz returned to Mauston and got in touch with the Juneau County Sheriff's Office. After learning all the new information that the siblings had dug up on Jeannie's disappearance, the sheriff's office agreed to reopen the case and launch a new investigation. The National Center for Missing and Exploited Children also agreed to put together and release an age-progressed composite sketch of Jeannie to show what she might look like at the age of 60, and more updated sketches were subsequently released in 2012 and 2020. The new investigation would be at a serious disadvantage because by this point, Jeannie's parents and grandparents had all passed away, and all of the original records about the house fire and Jeannie's disappearance had been destroyed in a flood. The most promising lead was the daughter of this other man whom Opal had supposedly conducted an affair with. She was still alive and living in Minnesota and consented to a DNA test in 2006, but the results showed that she had no genetic connection to the Bryant family, and she was ruled out as being Jeannie. Regardless, the sheriff's office took DNA samples from each of Jeannie's siblings and had them entered into a national database on the chance that any more potential matches popped up in the future. Tragically, Forrest passed away in 2017, while Sharon died in 2020, so Liz is the only surviving sibling from the Bryant family. However, the investigation into the case remains open, and if she is still alive at the time of this recording, Ricky Jean Bryant would currently be 77 years old. But after several decades, there are still no conclusive answers about what actually happened to her. So I guess you could say, the trail went cold. So during the intro, I made comparisons between this case and two other unsolved mysteries which occurred on Christmas Eve. The disappearance of siblings Maurice, Martha, Louis, Jenny, and Betty Sauter, which took place at the family's residence in rural West Virginia in 1945, and the disappearance of two-year-old Mary Elizabeth Edens, which took place at a schoolhouse in rural Oklahoma in 1924. And now we have the disappearance of Ricky Jean Bryant, which occurred in rural Wisconsin a few days before Christmas in 1949. I'm sure you've noticed a pattern here, as all these cases took place several decades ago, during a time period when forensic science was very primitive. If any of these fires took place today, there's a good chance that the authorities would have been able to determine beyond a shadow of a doubt if these missing children actually died during the fires. After all these years, that seems to be the general consensus in the Sauter children case, because even though there's still a good chance that the house fire was a deliberate act of arson caused by an unknown party, it seems very unlikely that five children from the same family could have been covertly abducted and not one of them resurfaced after all these years. The big complication is that it took 7 hours for the area's volunteer fire department to arrive at the scene, and the fire continued to simmer that entire time. When you combine this with the fact that there was a large supply of coal inside the house at that time, and burning coal produces an incredible amount of heat, you can understand why there might have been nothing left of the children to find at the scene if they were killed in the fire. The big complication in the Mary Elizabeth Edens case is that this fire took place in an overcrowded schoolhouse and claimed the lives of 36 people, many of whom were burned beyond recognition. Since we're talking about the pre-DNA world of 1924, trying to separate the burned remains of a 2-year-old child from all these other victims would have been impossible. The only reason this story spiraled into such a mystery is because a woman named Grace Reynolds came forward during the 1950s who believed that she was the grown-up Mary and had been abducted from the scene by someone who raised her under a false identity. It was not until several decades later when new evidence came out to indicate that Grace was not actually Mary, so she may have actually perished in the fire after all. So could the same thing have happened to Ricky Jean Bryant? Did she die in the fire, and they didn't have the forensics to prove it back in 1949? Well, I can honestly say that there are enough oddities surrounding this case that I really can't say with 100% certainty. To law enforcement's credit, when Jeannie's surviving siblings brought their concerns to them over 55 years after the fact, they could have just easily blown them off, since an older cold case like this would be incredibly difficult to solve. But the Juneau County Sheriff's Office agreed to reopen the case, and I believe that the investigation is still active to this day. In July of 2017, Sean Goyette, the detective assigned to the case, did an interview with the media in which he addressed the challenges of investigating a disappearance which took place so many years ago, but also acknowledged that it was worth pursuing. Goyette stated, quote, "The problem is no one from the fire department is still around from back then, no one from the sheriff's department is still around, and some members of her family have passed. No one has come forward, and the case still sits on my desk. My gut feeling is she didn't perish in that fire." End quote. Indeed, there is still a chance that Jeannie could still be alive today and living under a false identity, and we now live in an age where we have the ability to confirm this with DNA testing, so we don't have another repeat of the Mary Elizabeth Edens / Grace Reynolds situation. Now, if you go into the newspaper archives to research this case, you'll find some articles from December of 1949 which report on the house fire, and based on those, There's no reason to believe this is anything more than a terrible tragedy. These articles mention the tiny fragments of what were believed to be bone particles in the rubble and were sent to the state crime laboratory for analysis, but oddly, I could find no follow-up reporting about this, as it seems like all the media coverage on the story came to a halt before the end of December. It was not until decades later, when news articles reported that the results of testing came back negative, but I'm not entirely sure what that means. They obviously wouldn't have been able to perform DNA testing back then, but I'm guessing that the samples were so small that they couldn't even determine if these fragments were human bone particles, let alone that they belonged to Jeannie. And I somehow doubt that these particles are still around today for further analysis. There's been some debate about whether this blaze would have been strong enough to completely destroy Jeannie's remains and ensure that no trace of her was found. On one hand, the fire was described as being so hot that it melted metal inside the house. But on the other hand, the fire department showed up to the scene and extinguished the flames relatively quickly, so this isn't a solder children type situation where the fire simmered for 7 straight hours. And this isn't a Mary Elizabeth Edens type situation where the remains of 3 dozen burned victims were crammed together in a confined space. So if Jeannie died in the fire, isn't it reasonable to assume that at least some trace of her would have been found? I think one key detail which is still unknown and might shed a lot of light on this case is the actual cause of the fire. The original news articles state that the cause could not yet be determined, and since all media coverage of this story ceased within days, it's never been reported if investigators did figure out the cause. But I'd like to think that if they found any evidence that arson had taken place, it would have been reported on by the press and treated like a much bigger deal, since this would turn the situation into a criminal investigation that potentially cost the life of a child. The official story published in the press at that time is that Helen Halverson managed to get Forrest and Liz out of the house before she ran back inside to search for Jeannie. When she couldn't find her, Helen used a ladder to climb to a second-floor bedroom window and rescue her invalid husband, Casper. None of the contemporary articles mention anything about this mysterious blonde woman who showed up at the scene in an expensive-looking car before she told Forrest to go to a neighbor's house to call for help. I haven't seen any indication that Forrest ever told anyone about this woman until he reunited with his siblings to discuss the incident in 1985. Obviously, the biggest issue is that Forrest was only 5 years old at the time, so you have to wonder how reliable his memory was. And since Helen was deceased by the time this information went public, she could no longer refute this version of events. Interestingly enough, during one interview, Sharon claimed that Forrest struggled with a stuttering problem when he was a child, but she did not recall him having this issue before the fire. So you have to wonder if the trauma of the situation, as well as the possible burden of carrying a secret all these years, may have caused Forrest to develop a speech impediment. I noticed that when this story started getting media exposure during the mid-2000s, it seemed like Sharon and Liz did all the talking with the press while Forrest remained silent, as his sisters pretty much shared his account of that day secondhand. The key difference between these two accounts is that Forrest claims that Jeannie was brought out into the yard with him and Liz and only disappeared after the blonde woman showed up, whereas Helen maintains that Jeannie never made it outside at all. But in spite of Forrest's young age, he does have one witness backing up his version of events, and that's the neighbor, Irene Carlson, who confirmed that Forrest ran to her house to call for help before she followed him back to the farm. Irene is the one who shared the story about Helen being more concerned about getting canned goods and a fur coat out of the house than rescuing Jeannie and lying to her about Jeannie being with relatives. This totally contradicts Helen's account that she searched the house in vain for Jeannie but could not find her. If Irene's story is true, then this paints a pretty damning picture of Helen and suggests that she already knew what happened to her granddaughter at that point. But I should add the disclaimer that over 35 years passed before Irene shared her story with Jeannie's siblings, and it's not clear to me if Irene ever spoke to law enforcement, as she may have already been deceased by the time the case was reopened in 2005. So whether you believe Jeannie was abducted will depend on how much stock you put into Forrest and Irene's memories. If you believe Forrest's account, the implication seems to be that the mysterious blonde woman directed him to Irene's house in order to get him away from the scene so she could kidnap Jeannie. According to Forrest, The woman specifically told him to go to the Carlson residence because the phone wasn't working at the house, which was much closer to their farm. But how could she have possibly known that? And if this woman was just a random stranger who just happened to be passing by and saw a fire, why would she not just take the initiative to go to a house and call for help herself rather than getting a 5-year-old kid to do it? Of course, if an abduction took place, then you'd have to think it was pre-planned, because what are the odds of a random kidnapper just coming across this flaming farmhouse in a rural area with a bunch of unattended children sitting outside? I know this was an era when individuals like Georgia Tan ran illegal adoption agencies which involved stealing children from poor families in order to adopt them out to more wealthy families at a high price on the black market. Since Opal and Helen apparently seemed to come into an unexplained sum of money following the fire, and the blonde was described as driving an expensive-looking car, perhaps they decided to sell off one of their children. But that scenario doesn't make much sense, because why would this woman kidnap Jeannie and leave Liz behind? If you wanted to sell one of your children, why not choose the youngest, who would have a lesser chance of retaining memories of her birth family? It really does seem like Jeannie was the intended target, and the abductor had to figure out how to get Forrest away from the scene. And she did not feel the need to do the same thing with Liz, since she was only 18 months old, and would not be able to talk about anything she had seen. So if Forrest's story was true, the prevailing theory seems to be that Jeannie may have been conceived out of wedlock when her mother had an affair with another man, prompting Opal and Helen to orchestrate a house fire in order to fake Jeannie's death so she would be raised elsewhere, possibly by her biological father. Jeannie's siblings have all claimed that their mother and grandmother got over the tragedy remarkably quickly and seemed to immediately accept that Jeannie was dead, even without positive confirmation that her remains were found in the rubble. Hal Sharon said that when Opal picked her up at school later that same day, she was already ordering her never to speak of Jeannie's name, which is a terrible way to help a kid deal with the trauma of losing her sister. The whole situation is in sharp contrast to their father Raymond, who was out of town when the fire took place and seemed a lot more skeptical to the idea that Jeannie died that day. I know that Raymond had already passed away by the time the case was reopened several decades later, but if he had still been alive, I would have loved to hear his perspective about what he believed happened to his daughter. We don't really have any ideas about why Raymond and Opal decided to divorce 10 years after the fire, but it's odd how Opal wanted to take Liz out of state in order to raise her, but had no interest in doing the same with Sharon and Forrest because they were, quote-unquote, too much like their father. That could be read as a none-too-subtle hint that she had a child with another man who was not their father after they were born. The idea of Opal carrying on an extramarital affair is not implausible because Raymond worked as a truck driver, meaning that he would often be out on the road. And from what the children recall, whenever their father left for work, their mother would then decide to leave on unexplained trips immediately thereafter and rely on their grandmother to watch over them. If Opal became pregnant with Jeannie while having an affair with another man and tried to pass the girl off as her own husband's child, it would obviously be a major scandal if the truth ever came out, particularly during the late 1940s. But since we never got to hear Raymond's perspective on the situation, was there any danger of him finding out that Jeannie was not his daughter? If Opal's side of the family orchestrated a conspiracy to fake Jeannie's death, it's pretty odd that they would decide to do so 4 years after she was born, particularly since Raymond and Opal had since gone on to have another child. The only explanation I can think of is that perhaps the man Opal was having an affair with found out that Jeannie was his daughter and wanted to raise her as his own, so he threatened to expose this big secret unless Opal gave her to him. If he offered to pay Opal for this, then that would explain why she seemed to have a fur coat before the fire took place, even though the family barely had any money. Of course, if this is what happened, that still doesn't explain who the blonde woman was and why she would agree to assist Opal's lover with a child abduction. I guess you can't completely write off the idea that the woman worked for some sort of black market adoption agency and paid Opal off to take her child. But remember, we have these accounts of Opal continuing to take unexplained trips in the years after the fire. These continued to take place even after she relocated to Washington State, as she would return to the Midwest to see her children, leave them with relatives, and then just go off for days at a time. It's been suspected that Opal kept taking all these secret side trips in order to go see Genie, so even if she made arrangements to give Genie away, this implies that Opal was still allowed to visit her. While an extramarital affair would be a logical reason for these secret trips while Opal was still married, why would she keep doing them after she's gotten divorced? Unless, of course, she was keeping in touch with her missing daughter. All that being said, even though there are a number of good reasons to be suspicious of Opal and Helen, there are just as many reasons to be skeptical of the theory that they orchestrated the whole thing, as there are much simpler ways to give a child away than burning down your own house. Remember, the Bryant family did not have much money, had no insurance on the house, and pretty much lost all of their personal possessions, so even if they were well compensated for their actions, this is still a pretty extreme way to do things. The initial press coverage reported that another local resident allowed the Bryants to borrow his house in order to celebrate Christmas, and that the community was starting an effort to raise money for them, but unfortunately, we don't have any more specific details about how the situation affected them financially and how long it took for them to move into a new home. Obviously, if they had a sudden influx of money that allowed them to purchase a new home relatively quickly, then that might look awfully suspicious. What we do know is that Raymond and Opal were both away from the farmhouse on the afternoon it caught fire, so if this was a setup, Helen would have had to orchestrate the entire thing single-handedly, even though she was 61 years old at that time. I'm sure the grandfather, Casper, wouldn't have been able to do much since he was 78 years old and described as being invalid, and his presence is one of the main reasons why it's hard to imagine Helen starting the fire herself. As you recall, the official story is that Helen had to climb up a ladder in order to rescue Casper from the upstairs bedroom, but I'd be curious to know if Forrest and Irene personally witnessed this. It doesn't mention anything about Casper being outside the house when Irene arrived there, and it would be awfully strange if Helen was more concerned about rescuing the fur coat and canned goods while her husband was trapped on the second level of a burning house. But one aspect of this story which is a verified fact is that Casper did suffer burns on his face and hands, and while they weren't fatal, they were reported as being quote-unquote painful. In fact, Casper passed away only 5 months later in May of 1950, and while he was an elderly man, I have to wonder if the burns or the trauma of the situation might have sped up his demise. If Helen was responsible for this, she wound up putting her own husband at huge risk, and I'd like to think she would have at least ensured that Casper was on the ground floor before she started a fire, so that his escape would be much easier. Another detail from the original press coverage, which blows a hole in the theory that Genie was abducted, is that one of the firefighters claimed that he could hear screams from the flaming house, though he failed to find anything when he ran inside. It's certainly possible that his ears were playing tricks on him, but if he really did hear screaming, then this suggests that Genie was still in there, and perhaps the flames consumed her so thoroughly, or she was trapped under so much rubble, that there was nothing left to find once the area was searched. So one person who seemed to have inside knowledge of Opal's secret life was her second cousin, Lois Kane, and for a while, it seemed like she might hold the key to the mystery, as she pointed Jeannie's siblings towards a woman who was the daughter of the man Opal had supposedly been having an affair with. She was around the same age as Genie and lived in Minnesota, which is where Opal went on a number of her secret trips. So I'm sure she seemed like a good candidate to be Genie, but DNA testing ruled this possibility out. We don't have any further information about this woman, as Jeannie's siblings wanted to protect her privacy, but the testing took place back in 2006, and the woman was described as being very ill at that time, so I'm not entirely sure if she's still with us right now. But by the sound of things, she consented to the DNA testing without hesitation, so she probably sensed that there was something off about her background, and may have legitimately believed she was Genie. Since her name was never released publicly, we obviously don't know the identity of her father, but I do get the sense that something was going on between him and Opal, and while she may not have actually given birth to his illegitimate child, it sounds like she definitely had a lot of secrets. One final detail I find curious is how in 1979, Jeannie's siblings said that Opal suddenly decided that she wanted to put up a headstone for Genie at a cemetery in Iowa, even though her remains were never found. This is in sharp contrast to how Opal treated the loss of her daughter in 1949, as she had no interest of having a funeral for Jeannie or getting her a headstone, so why would she suddenly decide to do this 30 years later? And why would she choose a cemetery in Hesper, Iowa? If you go to the Find a Grave website, Opal and Helen's graves are located in Green Hills Memorial Cemetery in Burlington, Washington, so why not put Jeannie's headstone there? It's worth noting that Helen passed away in April of 1979, so perhaps Opal was just feeling sentimental around that time period. But another possibility is that if Jeannie was given away, she may have died while living under her new identity at another location, such as Iowa. If Jeannie passed away before or during 1979, Opal may have felt compelled to do something to pay tribute to her, and if Helen knew the truth and had helped cover something up, she was no longer around to prevent this. In many cases where infants or toddlers are the victims of an abduction, there is speculation that they might be living under a false identity somewhere and are completely unaware of who they really are. But this situation is a bit different because if Opal was making secret trips to visit Jeannie over the years, wouldn't Jeannie know who her mother is and the truth about her backstory? If so, she has never felt compelled to come forward and make contact with her siblings, even after her disappearance started generating publicity. Under normal circumstances, I would probably be inclined to go with Occam's razor and believe that Jeannie died in the fire, but there are definitely a lot of strange things about this case which cannot be ignored. But let's not forget that these oddities are based on the memories of someone who was a 5-year-old child at that time. For all we know, he could have dreamed up the whole situation with the blonde woman in his own mind in order to give himself and his siblings hope that Jeannie was still alive somewhere. And while Opal's lack of emotion over the whole situation, as well as her unwillingness to allow her children to speak about Jeannie, are very strange, people just sometimes handle grief in different ways, and perhaps her unwillingness to acknowledge her deceased daughter was just her way of dealing with things. At the very least, I think that Opal was conducting a secret affair, and that Helen may have been enabling her and covering for her, but burning down their house in order to fake a child's death and give her away does seem pretty over the top. If we had a fresher perspective of these events, I might have an easier time figuring out what actually happened here, but most of the information we know did not come out until several decades after the fact, when most of the key principals were already dead. But one of the cold case detectives has openly stated that his gut feeling is that Jeannie did not perish in the fire, so there definitely seems to be something here. The best case scenario is that Jeannie did survive and went on to live a long and happy life under a new identity and might still be alive today. Unfortunately, the only surviving sibling from the Bryant family is Liz, as Forrest and Sharon passed away before learning the truth, but it would still be nice if a miracle happened and Liz was able to have a reunion with her long-lost sister. So if you happen to have any information about the disappearance of Ricky Jean Bryant, or you think you might actually be Ricky Jean Bryant, please contact the Juneau County Sheriff's Office at 608-847-5649. That's 608-847-5649. But if you just have your own thoughts about what happened, feel free to leave me a comment or send me an email to robin.warder@icloud.com. That's robin.warder@icloud.com. Another reminder that The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so please visit patreon.com/thetrailwentcold to learn how you can support our podcast and become eligible for some pretty neat rewards. This past month, I released a bonus episode about the murder of Eileen Mangold, a case from Unsolved Mysteries which really should have been solved but wasn't. I've also dropped an exclusive bonus episode from my spin-off podcast, The Path Went Chilly, in which myself and my two co-hosts, Jules and Ashley, cover yet another case from Unsolved Mysteries, the unexplained 1990 death of Chad Maurer. And for our patrons in Tier 3, I've recorded another new audio commentary track, which can be played over a classic episode of Unsolved Mysteries. I'd also like to give a shout-out to our most recent listeners who have signed up with us on Patreon this week, and they are Preston H. and Heather Colleen P. Thank you so much for your support. I just wanted to give another shout-out to my supporters at the Unsolved Mysteries message board at the Sitcoms Online forum and the Unresolved Mysteries subreddit, and of course lostandfoundblogs.com, the website where I first learned about this story. I need to provide a big thanks to Miguel Foote, who edits and assembles this podcast together for me, and Vince Nitro, who composes the eerie music you hear on every episode. If you haven't already, you can like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, or leave us a rating or review on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, or Spotify. Anyway, like I mentioned in the intro, I will be on Christmas vacation for the rest of the year, so this will be my last official episode covering an unsolved cold case for the next few weeks. But in my absence, we will be releasing a special Q&A episode next week before we start off 2023 by releasing a special update episode. So we hope you all have a safe and happy holidays and a happy new year, and join us again next week for another episode of The Trail Went Cold.